And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Connan. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
We're going to have Keith Bolander on today, and Keith Bolander is going to be giving a talk. And there's a lot of interesting news with apropos of Cuba-U.S. relations, and there's an odd background to this today because the U.S. government has announced today that it regards Venezuela as a threat to U.S. national security.
Oh.
So.
Well, I'm not surprised.
One step forward and a double backflip into the abyss.
Yeah.
On Wednesday, the 11th of March at 6:30 p.m., there's going to be a cocktail reception following the talks. It's going to be the Great Thaw, Cuba and American Relations Moving Towards Normalization. I want to put an end in there, normalization. And the speakers are Cuban Consul General Javier Ruiz and Cuba expert Keith Bolander, journalist and writer. And there will be a book signing there as well. And that's at 6:30, Wednesday, 11 March, at Samara, 33 Prince Arthur Avenue. That's near Bedford Exit, St. George. So, do you know this venue, Phil?
I don't know this venue. It's,
all right. This will be a new one for you. You get over there and get your book signed. Yeah. By the way, there's limited space, so make your plans. First come, first serve basis. There's no executive class. 416-590-0630 for more information. And that number again, 416-590-0630. The Canadian International Council, Toronto Branch, presents, in cooperation with Samara, The Great Thaw, Cuba-American Relations Moving Towards Normalization. Let's hope so. And Keith Bolander, just as I just mentioned, is a freelance journalist and has written extensively on Cuban matters for a variety of publications. He's been involved with the Cuban projects for more than 20 years, a member of the Institute for Public Accuracy, IPA, on their roster of experts for Cuban affairs, the lecturer on the Cuban Revolution at the University of Toronto School, the University of Toronto School of Continuing Education. So Keith Bolander will be our guest in about 30 minutes. There's a couple of matters I want to make sure we touch on today. Of course, Phil, I just told you this news, and it is breaking news today that the Obama administration is acting in a pretty hostile way towards the government of Venezuela, linked perhaps to the fact that there was an attempted coup, and there are probably some efforts still ongoing by parties wishing to make a coup in Venezuela. The Venezuelans have accused the United States of having a hand in this, and they have asked that the U.S. reduce its they told them they had to reduce their embassy staff by quite a number, bringing it down from over 100 to, I think, 16, which is not a terribly that's not the most hostile thing. It's a reaction to a situation. As a matter of fact, you might say it's more than reasonable, since, after all, the accusation is an attempted coup involving U.S. Personnel. There was, at the time of Hugo Chavez, an attempt to remove him, and within hours, U.S. was announcing they were going to recognize the new government. So the Venezuelans aren't imagining anything. To me, the most important element is to remember is that the governments of South America are practically unanimously on the side of the government of Caracas, saying, it's time for the U.S. to stop meddling in the internal affairs of South American states. When the U.S. makes an announcement such as the one is made today, you have to think, why would they not, in that announcement, have something to say about the position of the governments of Bolivia, Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador? As the old expression is, what are they, chopped liver? If they tell you there was an attempt you can say, well, we weren't involved, if you like, and we find Venezuela's position unreasonable, you would at least be on a track of something resembling a dialogue or a discussion, how best to go forward. But this is U.S. saying, no, we don't care what anybody else thinks. This is what we're going to do. And they are used to having their way. And so this is a matter that I wish we had gone into in more detail previous, because for the past month or so, there's been some really important writing going on about the describing the U.S. Plans and also the activity of elements within Venezuela who are bent on illegally bringing down the government of Venezuela. So we will come back to that, but that is the news today. By the way, we will add that to our discussion with anticipating with Keith Bolander, because this is very, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for, strange, odd, peculiar, running counter to the impression. People say, well, you know, U.S. seems to be growing up a little bit. They've recognized that 50 years of trying to dictate to Cuba was foolish. And by the way, it drew the antagonism of all of South America, to go back to that point. They became very hostile throughout this whole, that whole period, said, enough of this. Cuban government is legitimate, certainly more legitimate than most of the South American governments, and stop this unproductive relationship. And the Obama, everybody said, well, he finally showed his the fact that he's educated and semi-civilized or whatever, and that he's going to change policies. But, you know, to follow right on the heels of that, the Venezuelan, this new really aggressive attitude towards Venezuela has to give one pause. we had to, there's a matter that all Canadians are aware of, and I hope others around the continent and around the world are following. We had the release last week of the video of Michael Zehaf Bibo. And the event was on October 22. Mr. Bibo killed a Canadian soldier, made a rush at the Parliament buildings, got into the Parliament buildings, was gunned down. And at the time, we were informed. By the way, we weren't immediately informed. It seems to me there was quite a delay before someone said, oh, by the way, there's a video. And then people said, well, this is a democracy. It's the people who elect representatives, and we all listen to the information. Our representatives debate what would be best, and then we do it. But there's a kind of mind that says, no, the information belongs to me personally or to my special organization, and you cannot have that. And it was a rather ugly episode where the head of the RCMP says, well, he's coherent, and we know what his position was ideological, but I'm not going to show you the evidence. And there were a number of people. Thomas Mulcair was the more vocal. By the way, Mulcair got somewhat isolated. People say, "Oh, Mulcair, he says he wants to see it." This is the part where you start talking about Cuba, Venezuela, et cetera, what democracy is. Mulcair was the only leader that said he thought we should see it. The leader of the Liberal Party said, no, I take his word for it. And by the way, at the same press conference where he said, take my word for it, he said that he had been planning to go to Syria. And the mother of Zehaf Bibo said, no, he wasn't planning to go to Syria. He was planning to go to Saudi Arabia. Well, and that turned out to be true, that it was Saudi Arabia. So you say, well, why did the head of the RCMP tell us that he was going to Syria? Well, because, you see, we have a story going there. That's bad Syria, and that's where this. So it gave drama and question and saga and anti-terrorist legislation. And he had all that mixed up. If you say Saudi Arabia, you'd say, oh, yeah, that's right. The monarchy that supports the ISIS people. the ones who have a lot of backdoor relationships to the terrorists. Saudi Arabia, about whom we do nothing. We never break relations. We never threaten anything. When we, our democratic ho-ho leaders go there, they fall at their feet. They say, oh, you're great, you're marvelous, we're so lucky to have a relationship with you, the monarch. So that was where Mr. Zahaf was going. We only knew that because Zahaf Bibo's mother was a very brave person. Her life has just become a disaster because her son killed this Canadian soldier. He was standing guard duty, wasn't even armed. And she had to live with that. But she at least did what was really helpful to the society. She said, well, let's get a story straight about my son. He had a drug addiction. He had mental problems. And he had been seeing and getting professional attempts at assistance. But, of course, that didn't really fit the story of the people who were writing the great narrative so that we go and do things. But at any rate, going back, there was not a demand to share this video so that we could analyze it. And if you remember, look at the Charlie Hebdo case. The night that this all happened, with the deaths of the people at the Hebdo offices, plus later shootout with the, I guess it was a day or two later, they had the shootout and deaths of the perpetrators and a second guy. It was all bloody and quite frightening for any ordinary population. But there was a video, and the French put that on television. And we all looked at it, and it was curious, but it gave us something to go on. Because, there's this kind of concept of advice and consent, you might say, where they say, we're going to do this. And you say, why? And they say, well, because of the following reasons. Well, and then you get to say, can you show me some evidence? Because this is an open society, free society. And if you want to have a policy, you have to consult. So that happened in France, but it didn't happen here. Incidentally, there's also, remember the bloody incident in Britain. People got interviewed who were involved and that killing of the soldiers. But everybody, again, could see these things. But we were told, no, you won't see it. And I guess my point is this. What's the matter with us? It's not, forget about them. Why don't we have enough courage to say, just give me the evidence and don't give me any run around about this? Brings me to an editorial written by the Ottawa Citizen in which they say the following. Canadians should have seen the video made by Michael Zahaf Bibo months ago. Canadians should have seen that video months ago. Even now, because the video has just now been released, astoundingly, the RCMP won't show us the whole thing. Did you know this, Phil? There's 18 seconds.
Yes, yeah.
Won't show us the whole thing. Commissioner Bob Paulson had better have a sound investigative or ethical reason for censoring the video, because Canadians have been treated like children long enough. This is Ottawa's Citizen. I got to tell you, it's one of the best editorials I've read in a long time. I just recently realized how good the Ottawa Citizen is. Canadians have been treated like children long enough. Paulson presented the video to a parliamentary committee and said that 18 seconds had been edited out for operational reasons he would not disclose. 13 seconds at the beginning and 5 seconds at the end. Presumably, if the reasons truly are operational, we'll be able to see the edited parts eventually. What we did see was not surprising, given that reporting has revealed so far and hints dropped by government ministers. In the video, Zahaf Bibo says that his actions are in retaliation for Afghanistan and because Harper wants us to send his troops to Iraq. He includes himself among the Mujahideen of the world. He rambles about Canadian society, although he was born and raised in this country. And then he said, and Bibo said, it's a disgrace, you guys have forgotten God and have let seek every indecency and things running your land. We don't we don't go for this. And then they said, in other words, vague Islamist boilerplate. This was what we had to wait 4.5 months to see? 4.5 months before we could be shown this. The long wait, the dramatic buildup, and the mysterious edits have all imbued this video with political significance it would not have had if the RCMP had simply shown it to Canadians in the days after the attack. This is convenient for the government, which has, in the meantime, got into the habit of using the October 22 attack as a justification for its terrorism legislation, adding even more weight to this one man's words. Then later in the editorial, they write, "In fact, the release of the video demonstrates the foolishness of keeping information from the public for the public's ostensible protection. The proposed law against the promotion of or advocacy of terrorism is misguided and undemocratic. Parliamentarians and citizens needed to see this video to better understand how and why this man attacked us. The banality and fundamental stupidity of evil needs to be continually uncovered and exposed to the light of day so we know what we're dealing with and can counter it more effectively. Keeping it secret only gives it a mystique it does not deserve." That's Ottawa Citizen. The editorial was on the, you can find it in the weekend edition, I believe. This matter is rather clear, I would guess. That's the part that troubles me, is where they say we've been treated like children long enough. The additional question is, or could be, well, why are we tolerating it? And you could say maybe it's a habit. Perhaps we need to become a little more noisy about our rights. And, you know, there's another aspect to it, which is also being mentioned, and that is that we actually don't have a report on what happened when he entered the Parliament building. Did you know that, Phil?
I know that if somebody asked me what happened, I can't tell you. He went in there and he's dead, and that's about it.
And we're told that a brave guy killed him,
right?
Except that now we're told that he was shot multiple times. Well, who fired how many shots? The Toronto Star on the weekend ran a photograph of the of his weapon, which is a 30-30 Winchester lever action, a very primitive looking, nasty rifle. And he, we're not, here's a question I've had from the beginning. Did he fire all the shots in that weapon? Was he, any chance that he was out of ammunition? I'd like to know such things as that. And when they say he was shot multiple times, and by the way, that was the way the CBC and others were reading the news, multiple times, we're told, they said, like today, March 2015, they're telling me, like for the first time, multiple wounds. You know, an autopsy was done, so not only can you tell me how many, if the journalists were on the ball and said, hey, give us the facts, we would know how many wounds there were, and of what type, because the other issue is, I know we're told that one guy was a hero, but if it's multiple wounds, it seems as though many people might have hit him in firing. And then there's a question of, well, then you check everybody's weapon to see who fired what, so that you know what happened. And you also know which shot was fatal. Recently, I was following the case very closely of the this American sniper who was killed. And I was interested in, finally, you know, on the stand, a forensics expert told which shots were fatal. He said this one, he pointed at the wound, and said this one was fatal. In other words, he would have survived, likely, if he'd been hit, you know, but only the other, but this one. And they can tell you that sort of thing. But we're acting like it's the 19th century. And again, I have to echo the Ottawa Citizen. Why are we being treated like children? And then why are we acting like children? Why don't we just say, fundamentally, you don't have to trust somebody who won't share information with you because he doesn't trust you. So you have to not trust him back. You owe him that. If he doesn't trust you, don't trust him back. You have to say, no, I think you're probably lying. I have to conclude you're probably lying because you don't care to share that with me, right? Anyway, that's a matter we're going to stay with.
Can I mention one other odd aspect of this thing? The hero who is accredited with having shot him, although he had no background in diplomatic work, got appointed an ambassador by Harper.
Yes.
And nobody's explained that. What is that all about?
Everybody thought that was wonderful. They said, that was inspired.
Yeah.
You say, what? It's a payoff. I understand that. He's a brave man. He gets but really, is that the... Of course, they appointed Dennis McDermott got appointed ambassador to Ireland by Mulroney. And you say, that sounds like an inside deal, doesn't it? I never understood that. Now, there's another matter I want to touch on. And by the way, Keith Bolander will be here fairly soon. And we look forward to that. There's a very good writer we've had on the show who writes on military matters. We don't have enough in Canada, enough writers who focus on the politics of the military. And one of them is Scott Taylor. And he wrote an article, you can find it on the net, called On Target, Canadians Must Know End Game Before Mission in Iraq is Extended. And I think it's worth getting his take on this incident that happened over the weekend of the killing of one Canadian soldier and the wounding of three others. Last week, just prior to the shocking friendly fire incident that left Sergeant Joseph Dwarion dead, the three fellow Canadian Special Forces soldiers wounded, newly minted Foreign Affairs Minister Rob Nicholson made a covert visit to Iraq. Nicholson's junket came on the eve of Canada having to decide whether it will extend its six-month military commitment beyond the current April 7 deadline. Immediately upon returning to the safer soil of neighboring Jordan, Nicholson advised reporters via teleconference that Canadians should brace themselves for an extended mission. Without any hint of irony, Nicholson prophesied that the campaign against ISIS in Iraq could very well mirror Canada's more than decade-long deployment to battle the Taliban in Afghanistan. Being in this for the long term is similar to what we did in Afghanistan, for instance, he stated. We were in Afghanistan, but we indicated that we would continue our assistance, and we have in Afghanistan. For the record, Canada, and this is Scott Taylor's point, For the record, Canada ended its combat mission in July 2011 and completely withdrew all military personnel in March 2014, although the Harper government staged an elaborate day of honor to recognize the sacrifice and courage of our troops who fought in that bloody counterinsurgency. No one in their right mind would ever pretend that we were victorious in Afghanistan. With the United States forces largely withdrawn, Afghan security forces have been unable to contain a resurgent Taliban, with violence across the country currently at the highest levels since the U.S. invasion in 2001. In theory, the challenge of rebuilding a functioning state in post-Taliban Afghanistan would have been a cakewalk, compared with the complex inter-sectarian strife that presently grips Iraq. The fact that Nicholson had to make two stops in Iraq, first to meet the nominal central government officials in Baghdad, and then to meet with Kurdish leaders in the northern city of Erbil, illustrates that there is no single cohesive Iraq entity combating ISIS. The remnants of the impotent but elected regime in Baghdad are representatives of Iraq's Shiite majority, and they have always maintained close political ties with Iran. When the U.S.-trained Iraqi security forces dissolved last spring at the first sight of the ISIS fighters, the Baghdad leadership called out their Shiite militia and welcomed Iranian military advisors into their midst. A major battle is being waged by Iranian-led Iraqi Shiite militias to reclaim the ISIS-held Sunni stronghold of Tikrit. Despite battling a common enemy for a strategic objective, Canadian military officials confirmed to the media that the Shiite militia can expect no support from either Canadian or Allied warplanes. This is, of course, because Canada has labeled Iran as evil, and we cannot be seen using our military assets to help entrench further Iranian influence in Iraq, even if they're fighting ISIS terrorists and support Iraq's elected government. And he continues that the Kurds took advantage of the Iraqi military's collapse to launch their own offensive against the central government. This is some time back. In the initial chaotic days, the Kurdish militia pushed south to capture Babu Gurgur, pardon my fancy pronunciation, oil field outside the city of Kirkuk. And that oil field pumps about 35% of all Iraqi oil, and having this prize in their grasp makes an independent Kurdistan economically feasible. For the record, Kurdistan has existed as an autonomous region since the end of the First Persian War in 1991. It has its own flag, which Peshmerga militiamen proudly wear on their sleeves, and they fight for the establishment of their own state. What makes this politically problematic is that large tracts of land, which Kurds consider to be part of their nation, are currently within the borders of Syria and, importantly, Turkey. As a NATO ally, Turkey sees the creation of an independent Kurdistan as a potential lightning rod to reignite Kurdish separatist movement in the eastern provinces. During the 1990s, Turkish security forces battled Kurdish insurgents in a bloody campaign that led to over 30,000 people dead. Arming and training Kurdish militia and bombing ISIS in support of them may seem like the only short-term option available to Canada. God knows we cannot be seen to be supporting embattled Syrian President Bashar Assad, even though his loyalists are in the fight against ISIS. And we sure as hell can't bomb ISIS in support of those evil Iranians. But if we bomb ISIS in support of Kurds, their long-term goal is to break up Iraq and seize chunks of Syria and Turkey. Before any decision is taken extending our military mission in Iraq, I believe Canadians need to know the ultimate objective. Selectively bombing ISIS is not a strategy, and it is not enough to know what you are fighting against. You need to know what you're fighting for, especially now that we have started taking casualties. So far, it is clear that the Harper government hasn't a clue when it comes to Iraq. So, that's Scott Taylor. We spoke to him previously. You know, Scott Taylor was taken prisoner in that region. He was on the show with us and described his experience. He did tell us very, I remember vividly, that when you're in the region where the Canadian special forces are deployed, he said, you're not in Iraq. You don't see an Iraq flag. So we're getting headlines in the Star, Globe, et cetera, you know, our support for Iraq. But actually, our special forces are working with Kurdish elements who already regard themselves as an independent Kurdistan, which it's okay by me. It's just that what we need to know is that the Canadian strategy, because they keep using the word Iraq. Maybe they're not as dumb as they look, and then we're as dumb as we appear, that we put up with this kind of strange behavior. And just lastly, on what occurred, this I noticed that, boy, have we been treated to a public relations fiasco where I go to bed one night and they say, it turns out the Canadians showed up at a outpost and they didn't know the password and they got shot. And that the Kurdish forces are disappointed and find us bizarre. Then the next morning we're told, no, it was the other side's fault. And that actually our guys are very professional and we're dealing with amateurs over there. And I would say to them, I don't know if you're going to win the Canadian public into kind of a semi-racist idea that we can't trust the Peshmerga or whatnot, but since, after all, you call them your allies, you might have to pay them a minimum amount of respect. And if you do, that means you're going to have to listen to what they say. already today they're saying, oh, well, it was all started when one guy had the got flummoxed and pulled the trigger. And, okay, can we talk to the one guy? Because that isn't what the one guy said. He said something entirely different. I would say one other detail about this patrol. You have a vehicle. There's four Canadians in it, I gather. And they say, well, they're being completely professional. Well, I understand that they're there to assist and advise. That means to me there has to be a liaison officer. Four Canadians don't go out in the middle of the night in a war zone without their Peshmerga counterpart. Because if you do show up at an intersection with got a bunch of hardware, you want somebody there who really knows the situation. And he can say, fellas, it's me, and I got these four Canadians with me. You don't have Canadians show up on their own. That somebody really did screw up. That's what they really did. And the story is getting more exciting by the minute. What I would say is I really hope that we have journalists who, instead of just standing in front of a suit in Ottawa, will fly over there and start interviewing the combatants. Because in another detail in Scott Taylor's interviews recently, Scott Taylor says that the Peshmerga don't like the Canadians. They don't want them around. Because they think, probably, that this is another military force insinuated amongst them, and they have business to do. And they're not sure who these guys are or what it is they're up to. That's a natural military thing. You know, you can't have two police departments running one operation. Somebody has to take charge.